There is only one Pink Floyd. Over 30 years of irresistible music have seen 16 albums, numerous solo projects, and a whole series of live shows that have set a benchmark in theatrical and musical extravagance. In fact, so enduring is their popularity that they have transcended mere band status and become an untouchable entity whose back catalogue is still being enthusiastically discovered by generations of music fans, no matter what type of music is currently in fashion. The Floyd are simply timeless. I'm radio journalist Max Asanovich, and throughout this audio documentary, we shall have a look at the history of the band and attempt to understand how Pink Floyd have managed to leave such an indelible stamp upon the collective consciousness of all musical fans. George Roger Waters was born in the beautiful university town of Cambridge in England on the 9th of September 1943. His father died along with 36,000 other Allied troops in southern Italy during the Second World War, and although the two never met, Eric Fletcher Waters would have a significant effect on his songwriting. Waters would attend Cambridge High School for Boys, along with a lad called Roger Keith Barrett, who was so obsessed by Dylan and the Beatles that he had taught himself to play the banjo and the electric guitar by his mid-teens. On leaving high school, Barrett, who would later be nicknamed Sid, followed his artistic bent and moved to art school in London. Waters also moved to the capital, but with a more practical career in mind, enrolled in the Regent Street Polytechnic to study architecture. It was here that Waters met two like-minded students called Nick Mason and Rick Wright. Throughout 1965 and 1966, London was undoubtedly the trendiest place on earth to be, and with the city's music scene quite literally bursting at the seams, the three decided to get involved themselves. With Roger Waters on guitar, Nick Mason on drums, and accomplished pianist Rick Wright, our intrepid threesome formed Sigma Six and began gigging around town playing a combination of rhythm and blues and rock. As 1965 progressed, Sigma Six would change their name to T-Set, then to the Megadeths, then to the Architectural Abdabs, before finally settling on just the Abdabs. Soon afterwards, Mason and Wright let their flat out to two Cambridge musicians called Sid Barrett and Bob Close. Both men joined the band, and inspired by bluesman Pink Anderson and Floyd Council, Barrett changed the name of the band to Pink Floyd. The members of the band were given a great deal of confidence by the assured guitaring of Close, and with Waters moving on to the bass, their psychedelic concoction began to slowly take place. Although Bob Close left soon afterwards to pursue his love for jazz, the band, now heavily influenced by the songwriting of Barrett, began to make a hefty impression within the underground scene. They were also one of the first bands to experiment with a light show, where tracks such as Take Up Thy Stethoscope and Walk and The Gnome would be accompanied with a series of bizarre, colourful shapes projected onto a screen behind the band that would shadow their ever-increasing improvisations that the live Pink Floyd were now indulging in. The impression that these innovative light shows created was clearly not lost on the band. In 1966, Pink Floyd became the resident band at London's UFO Club, the hippest underground venue in London. By the following year, they had interested EMI sufficiently to secure a £5,000 advance, and on the 11th of March 1967, released their first single, Arnold Lane. The song was about a man who stole women's underwear from washing lines, and was actually banned by most radio stations for being too smutty. This did not prevent it from making the top 20, however, and as the famous Summer of Love reached its zenith, Pink Floyd released onto an unsuspecting world their debut album, The Piper at the Gates of Dawn, which came out on August the 5th. Throughout this audio documentary, we shall hear observations from two veritable Pink Floyd experts. The first is music journalist and record company director Richard Allen, whose label, Delirium Records, contains a number of celebrated neo-psychedelic bands, including the hugely popular Porcupine Tree. And secondly, we'll hear from Glenn Povey, an author who recently published a new book entitled Pink Floyd in the Flesh. Published by Bloomsbury, it's one of the most in-depth and complete books ever written about the band.
So, I mean, Piper at the Gates of Dawn today is captures an era. It hasn't really dated musically, but it's dated stylistically.
Especially that the Beatles were recording Sgt. Pepper at exactly the same time. Yet they have two very different albums, and in their own way they're quite timeless.
Yeah, I mean, the Beatles would like converted from being an R&B beat band to psychedelia, whereas Pink Floyd had almost started off as that.
Yeah. I'd say in their very early incarnation they were a blues band, but they seemed to incorporate or embrace psychedelic tendencies, if you like, very early on, whereas that's something that came much later with the Beatles.
But it was more avant-garde, perhaps?
Yeah, a lot more abstract. I think the lyrics are certainly very, if you like, quintessentially English.
Syd Barrett sort of was a major influence on their direction to start with.
I think he can probably be credited with leading the band from their earliest incarnations right through to this album, which, as we said, displays very sort of quirky pop songs, but also extended instrumental freakouts as well.
The album features studio versions of Floyd's most superbly psychedelic songs. The underground anthems, Astronomy Domain and Interstellar Overdrive, offered intriguing slices of psychedelia, coupled with the sheer power and magic of Syd Barrett's songwriting and guitar playing. He wrote 8 of the 11 songs on the album, and co-wrote 2 others. But while Syd was undoubtedly the spirit of the band, his excessive drug-taking was starting to have a dramatic effect on him. Things reached a head with the infamous performance on the Pat Boone Show in the US, when, on being interviewed by the host, Syd just stared blankly into the camera, completely devoid both physically and emotionally. Ironically, it was one of Syd's Cambridge pals who would eventually take his place in Pink Floyd. Dave Gilmour was born just outside Cambridge on the 6th of March 1946, and had played in a number of Cambridge bands, including the R&B influence Joker's Wild, who even released a single in 1968, Frankie Lyman's Why Do Fools Fall in Love. But as Syd's behaviour became more and more erratic, it soon became clear that he'd have to go. Initially, the band announced to the press that they had become a five-piece, but in early 1968, during the recording of their second album, A Saucer Full of Secrets, at the famous Abbey Road Studios in London, the band bowed to the inevitable and reluctantly dropped Syd from the band. The new album, released on the 29th of June 1968, reached number 5 in the UK charts and saw the band in a transitional period after Syd. The album featured recordings made during the Piper sessions the previous year in Jug Band Blues and Remember a Day, alongside post-Syd tracks from May 1968. Perhaps the most important song on the album was the carefully constructed title track that lasted almost 12 minutes, that apart from mapping out the direction the band would take for the next decade, also seemed to exercise the spirit of Syd. It is, of course, a matter of continued debate as to what dizzy heights Syd would have achieved musically if he had not addled his brain with mind-bending drugs. But his contribution to Pink Floyd is the stuff of legend, and those contributions will never be forgotten. Throughout 1968 and 1969, as their popularity grew, they managed to perform some fairly prestigious concerts, notably at the Royal Festival Hall and a free concert in Hyde Park, London. All this activity clearly impressed film director Barbet Schroeder, who asked them to provide a soundtrack for his film More, which, not too surprisingly perhaps, was about a group of drug-taking hippies in Ibiza.
People singing music like somebody saying, you know, Pink Floyd or like a really heavy underground group, but you have to see them when you stone me something. How do you think, you know, it's like bullshit, but how do you think, you know, audiences feel like when you're stoned and, you know, like they see you and, you know.
Well, it's just, I think it's, you know, it's, again, it's, that's rubbish that you need to be stoned to see us or anybody else.
How did you get to do the score of the movie More and Zabriskie Point?
How did we get to, they came and asked us to do
it? Right, because a lot of people might relate your music to the movie More, and, you know, it was all about drugs and things like that. They ask, why did you do the soundtrack and not another group, like, let's say, someone else, you know?
Well, we did it because he wanted us, Barbet Schroeder wanted us to use us.
Right.
We didn't do it because it was about drugs. And in fact, we said good things about drugs, anyway, and we said the right things.
Right.
I'm sure if it was saying the wrong things about drugs, we wouldn't have done it.
Although the film was by no means a resounding success, the soundtrack that was recorded in just 8 days, once again at the Abbey Road Studios in March 1969, shows Pink Floyd in a very relaxed and pastoral light. The album contained concert staples Cymbeline and Green is the Colour, which show Walter's songwriting was progressing nicely. Musically, it'd be one of Floyd's most varied releases, with the heavy metal sounding The Nile Song, the abstract and electronically fueled Quicksilver, and acoustic ballads such as The Crying Song. It was about this time that EMI formed a subsidiary in the shape of Harvest Records, and Pink Floyd moved sideways to join the new label. Considered a great pioneer at the time, Harvest Records also had Roy Harper, the new solo Syd Barrett, and Deep Purple on its books. Floyd's first release on Harvest was Umma Gumma, released just 3 months after Moore on October the 25th, 1969. This highly adventurous double album clearly cemented the band's cult status at the time, and unlike future releases, certainly conveys a spirit of adventure and optimism. The first side of the LP was a set of live tracks, recorded at two of Floyd's preferred venues, the Mother's Club in Birmingham and the Chamber of Commerce in Manchester, both in England. The second record was recorded in the studio, at the same time as Syd Barrett was attempting to record his first solo, the poignantly titled The Madcap Laughs, which was partly produced by Dave Gilmour and Roger Waters. The idea for the second part of Umma Gumma was that each group member was given half a side of vinyl each to fill. Let's hear once again from Glenn Povey and Richard Allen.
With the advent of Umma Gumma, it had a completely different direction altogether.
And Umma Gumma is like crossroads, really, for them.
I think it's interesting that you've got an album that's divided into a live portion, and you've got an album that's divided into quarters for solo pieces. But I don't think it works that well.
It's almost like they're experimenting.
But trying too hard at it, I think. And I think it shows that the individual members don't work as well as they do as a cohesive unit working together.
The standout track on the album was probably A Saucer Full of Secrets, and continuing the fragmentation is actually divided into four parts. It is often muted that one of the main considerations behind making all four band members contribute individually was to make sure that royalties were evenly split. The album proved popular though, reaching number 5 in the UK charts. However, with this commercial success, confusion now centred on whether they were still an underground band or not, something that caused Rick Wright and the rest of the band some consternation.
We're against classifications like underground, which is a rather meaningless phrase, because underground used to mean uncommercial, and it no longer means that, because underground is now commercial. Commercial means we're saleable. That, I mean, we have a commodity to offer which people will buy.
You say commercial. Which yes. is what you're thinking of.
Yes, you're understanding by the word commercial, sort of two-minute numbers. But we understand by the word commercial whether we can sell ourselves or not. I mean, we go out for the same sort of money as a...
People, if you asked anyone in the business, if you said to them, which is the more commercial group, Pink Floyd or The Love Affair? They would say, The Love Affair, you know, 10 out of 10, quite right, VG, if you're talking in those journalistic type of terms. But we made more of a sale here tonight. So if you're talking about tonight, then we're the more commercial group. For us to be able to sell gramophone records and go and play live in places, consequently we are, whether you like it or not, or I like it or not, a pop group. That's all a pop group is.
No, it's been said to someone. I'm not quite sure who it said. It seems ringing through my head. It was one of the Beatles that said it. That if you can't hum a tune, or if you do hum a tune, therefore it will be a hit. Okay? Do you consider that people can hum your tunes?
They can hum the basic rhythm. I mean, they can. Yeah, some of them can. A good hummer. A good hummer can cope with some of our tunes. Yes, but we don't. Our success live, or lack of success live, is not based on our ability to put over hummable tunes. Yeah, we improvise. We play a very crude form of jazz, if you want to be, meaning by jazz, improvisation.
But it was Pink Floyd's next release that would provide both Harvest and Pink Floyd with their first number one. Atom Heart Mother was released on October the 10th, 1970, and stormed to the top of the charts. The album also heralds the introduction of their Cambridge pal Storm Thorgerson's company, Hypnosis, as sleeve designers. The cover of the album featured a Frisian cowl named Lullabell III, whose brush of rock and roll fame would not stop there, appearing in later years on the cover of a Daryl Hall album and in the Sweet Dreams video by The Eurythmics. The most notable aspect of Atom Heart Mother was the title track on side one. It was devoted to a single theme, orchestrated and co-composed by Scotsman Ron Gessin, who introduced a cello player, a bass section to the track, not to mention a 20-strong choir. The album also contained Rick Wright's excellent Summer 68 and the bizarre Alan's Psychedelic Breakfast, which paid homage to Floyd's roadie Alan Stiles, who can claim rock immortality by being recorded washing himself and even frying bacon on the finished track. It was certainly a radical piece of music that the band only performed live once, during which they made tea and even cooked on stage. During this time, the band also toured fairly extensively around the States, a tour that was not without its mishaps, however, as Nick Mason explains.
Tell me about your instruments got stolen on the last tour.
Yeah. Did he explain about Omagumi?
Yes,
he explained about Omagumi.
Good. We were in New Orleans and someone had been, apparently, we later found out, driving our truck around. Someone took away our whole truck in a fit of pique, and with everything inside it. And so we rushed off to the police, who could have shown, I mean, were just not interested, of course. And then we were staying at this very smart hotel called the Royal Orleans in New Orleans, and with very nice young staff. And they all started saying, oh, well, my dad's the sheriff, or I know someone in the FBI or something. And this really groovy FBI geezer turned up. And really, you know, the whole thing changed immediately. There was some air of urgency about it. And we also put out on the radio and TV, you know, what had happened, and there was a reward and things. And like, about 9 hours later, they found the truck dumped, with and only three guitars missing. That's all?
That's all. What are your individual backgrounds in music before you got together as a group? You know, like, how did you get started playing drums?
Okay. Say upper class for me and middle class for the others. But our backgrounds in music could be described as sparse, with the exception of Richard Wright, who underwent a certain amount of training. But my background, my musical background prior to the Pink Floyd, could be described as sparse. I did have some violin lessons for a period of some weeks from a woman called Mrs. Tchaikovsky. But I don't think they've made a big impact on my approach to the drums.
How long does a group have to, like, really practice on, like, before a show or something? Like, how many hours?
Well, we don't practice very much. I mean,
a whole day for set up.
That's it? I mean, okay. The old material you completely haven't played it for a couple of weeks or days.
No, if we, I mean, some of the things we've been playing for 2 years.
Yeah, right, right.
So there's no problem. The other things, as long as we know the, all we have to practice, all we have to know is the basic structure of the piece. How long, you know, whether there's a chorus after a verse or a set, you know, decide the sort of way we're going to do it, and then it's up to us to play it. You know, to the audience, which is not a matter of rehearsal.
Right. Like, how long does it, like, take? Let's say you have to, you just write a song just to get it together, like Interstellar Overdrive or something like that.
That's the next thing. But, I mean, Interstellar Overdrive was written one day and performed the next.
Really?
It was, sometimes we'd learn songs on stage at Paris Gardens, didn't we?
Yeah, I mean, right at the beginning, we didn't rehearse. We just went on stage.
We rehearsed, but we didn't rehearse numbers, we just played.
We just played. In fact, if you like, we were jamming at that point.
Yeah.
Because we went on stage not knowing what we were going to do.
What do you feel about this change? The group's been doing, you know, heavy type of rock music with, you know, sound effect type things. And what is your feeling, you know, with classical music now and ballets and orchestras getting into the group now?
We weren't necessarily using orchestra. I mean, the orchestra was an experiment, and I've no doubt, you know, I'm sure we'll do something again with an orchestra, and this will go down, you know, as an experiment, and we'll relate to it in future things. But I don't think we're now committed to a course of action using an orchestra for all our future work or our future work over the next month. In fact, I think probably, and this is a sort of complete surmise, it's not a plan that we've got, but I suspect that we'll retreat from an orchestra now and go back and find out more about what the orchestra proved that we could do, you know, what we lost with an orchestra. We'll try and recapture between the four of us again, that sort of thing. You know, because obviously when you take on extra musicians and so on, you lose a certain mobility within, you know, within what you can do. And I think that we might go back and look for some of that. But then again, you know, after we've done that, we might go and try and have another go with an orchestra. Or we might
it's difficult to say, but I'm just saying it's not, you know, it's not a sort of cut and dry thing of staying with an orchestra now. Then you want.
The whimsical nature of Pink Floyd's music, inspired by the Syd Barrett days, had altogether disappeared from their sound by this time, with Walters now dominating proceedings both conceptually and lyrically. However, their next album, Medal, which was released on November the 13th, 1971, proved beyond doubt that Dave Gilmour was now leading the way musically. The 23-minute masterpiece Echoes, which was initially given the working title of Nothing's Part 1 to 24, clearly showcases Gilmour's ever-growing confidence and offers his first really significant guitar playing that would go a long way to defining Pink Floyd's sound. The album also introduced us to One of These Days, that would reappear again as a live track during the 90s concerts, and the excellent Fearless, which featured Liverpool Football Club's famous Cop End singing You'll Never Walk Alone. This album of evocative jams also proved successful with the record-buying public, making it to number 3 in the charts. The album was followed in June of 1972 by Obscured by Clouds, which again saw Pink Floyd team up with the film director Barbet Schroeder to produce the soundtrack to the French film La Vallée. The soundtrack was recorded in less than 2 weeks outside Paris for what turned out to be another fairly unsuccessful film. One of the most interesting efforts is Free Four, in which Roger Waters begins to make his first references to the death of his father, as well as taking a cynical sideswipe at the music business as a whole. Although the band were on a critical and commercial roll, not even the most ardent Pink Floyd devotee could possibly have predicted the overwhelming eminence that their next album would achieve. It is doubtful whether the two members of the band Machine Head could have envisaged the significance of the relative failure that their third album would have on rock history. Named after a reference to the occult name for the subconscious, their album, Dark Side of the Moon, failed to make any sort of impact, leaving the way clear for Roger Waters to adopt the same name for the forthcoming Pink Floyd album. Recorded again at Abbey Road and engineered by Alan Parsons, it ushered in the era of album-orientated rock and transformed Pink Floyd into the realms of musical legends. Because the album continues to sell, it's difficult to estimate its total sales to this point, but it is comfortably nudging on the 30 million mark, making it the highest-selling British album of all time, comfortably beating out such eminence as The Beatles, Led Zeppelin and The Stones. The album enjoyed unprecedented chart longevity, incredibly spending almost 15 years in the Billboard Top 200, and even to this day remains an absolute must for all self-respecting music fans. All the album's lyrics were written by Roger Waters, who had the idea of linking the songs with everyday problems, such as madness, work, death and ageing. It was the first album that the band had both written and toured with before going into the studio, originally showcasing it at North London's Rainbow Theatre under the name of Eclipse, Pieces for Assorted Lunatics. Dark Side of the Moon clearly touches a deep chord with music fans of all ages. Mammoth tracks like Money, Time and Brain Damage offer a powerful and terse musical statement with a meaningful and articulate message. It was undoubtedly a high watermark in the Pink Floyd Odyssey, which contained none of their earlier hippie optimism, but instead took a powerful and intense look into the dark corners of Waters' psyche. On the Run focuses on paranoia, while Time, with its cacophony of chiming clocks, indicates Waters' concern for aging, made even more surprising by the fact that he wrote it while still only 28. The one track that would probably force the biggest change on the band was Money, which enjoyed hitherto unparalleled success as a single, which would alter the makeup of the crowds that saw their live performances, as the formerly intense and anonymous Pink Floyd found themselves in the mass marketplace.
When you think of Pink Floyd, you think of Dark Side of the Moon, and it's probably their most influential album, particularly in production, and just the execution of the thing. They brought in a lot of other people into it, which makes the band sound almost like an orchestra in places.
Yeah, it's got a very warm, appealing sound, and I think that's brought on by the additional female backing vocals and saxophone.
Up until that point, they were not really successful on a worldwide scale.
I think that's right. I think because they were able to draw some very good catchy singles, if you like Money became an FM radio hit worldwide. So that completely took them from playing ballrooms to stadiums in one fell swoop.
And it's an album that appeals to a lot of people because it's not really it's not really defined what the lyrics. It could be about anything if you listen to it.
Yeah, I think that's the beauty of it. It's open to personal interpretation. It's not about a specific subject. People can draw their own conclusions with it and read into it what they want.
I gather you get a lot of mail from people that think they've discovered the meaning.
Oh yeah, you know, they think that it's all written about them as an individual, or, you know, you'd obviously get a lot of people thinking a lot of it's about Syd Barrett. But that's the beauty of the album. You can look into it whichever way you want.
In your book, you've spoken to lots of people that saw the band live. What sort of things did people say about their early shows?
Well, I think because they came from very humble beginnings and they were playing things like church halls and they were playing universities and small clubs, you've got a kind of very captive audience, very attentive audience. Whereas I think there's a definite change in the atmosphere at gigs after Dark Side of the Moon was released. And from there you've got them playing much larger venues, a much wider audience, and a lot of people there that are just for the sheer spectacle of it, and they're going out for a laugh, they're not going there to see Pink Floyd perform, you know, some very strange music or whatever. They're going there to have a party, and I think the kind of thing you tend to experience when you move up to stadium shows is a far less attentive crowd.
Now let's also hear from renowned British DJ and promoter JJ Fowler, who enthusiastically recalls the first time he heard Pink Floyd and what he felt about Dark Side of the Moon.
Their influence on modern music has been absolutely astounding. My first recollection of Pink Floyd was way back in the 70s, in the drug-oriented era that was the 70s. And I was in the early 70s in England. There was a big movement called the glam rock movement, which featured things like David Bowie and the Sweet and lots of other acts that really didn't break America, but here were top 10, number one. And one of those acts was an act called T-Rex, and their lead singer was a man called Mark Bolan. And he'd done a movie, a film, or just a live, basically live film of himself at Wembley Arena in London, England, and it was called Born to Boogie. And they showed it in cinemas, and I went along to my local cinema to watch Born to Boogie. And on before it, they had a film on before it, which was Pink Floyd in Pompeii, if I'm not mistaken. And this was just just basically Pink Floyd performing. And at that time, in the early 70s, I must admit that it bored me to death. I must admit, I just did not groove to it at all. It just went completely over my head. And I thought, what is this? But the strange thing is that later on, then in 1978, I went to see The Song Remains the Same, which of course is the Led Zeppelin movie of their US tour or whatever. And again, Pink Floyd and Pompeii was on. But in 78, for some unknown reason, I was a little bit older. I wasn't, you know, into kind of the kind of things you're into when you're really, really young, you know, that kind of, you know, puberty, you know, stage. And I went to see again Led Zeppelin, and it was on before it again. But this time, I really liked it, and I thought it was really, really good. And I thought, I must check out Pink Floyd. I must go and buy something. And the very next day, I did. I went out, and I, of course, got, you know, I spoke to some friends, and they suggested I got Dark Side of the Moon. And I bought it, and I put it on, and it completely blew my mind. I mean, it was just numbing. I mean, I was lucky that my parents had a really, really great stereo system, and he had it set up in quadraphonic. And I sat in the middle of the room and I put on this album, and for the first time ever, here was an album. I mean, Queen had done it, you know, Bohemian Rhapsody, they'd done, you know, if you had the system to listen to it at that time, you know, they'd done it with that on Now I'm Here. Queen had done it a little bit, but this was the first time that I had an entire album that went from speaker to speaker, you know, around the room. you know, and listening to it on headphones was even more mind-boggling, because on the headphones you heard things that you just did not, you know, you just couldn't think were there. But this was the point where listening to it in quadraphonic sound through four speakers, was the sounds just went around the room, and there was little bells and chimes and all this was going on. And every time, it seemed like every time you listened to it, you heard something that you never heard before. And that for me was phenomenal. And nobody was doing that. Nobody had ever done that. And it was stunning. Wow. I mean, thinking about it now, I mean, I can remember how I felt sitting in that room.
On September the 15th, 1975, Pink Floyd released Wish You Were Here, an album that has aged magnificently, although the band had many internal problems when recording it. With the impending divorces of both Nick Mason and Roger Waters, the band were also exhausted and affected by the fact that after their tremendous success of Dark Side of the Moon, they had effectively achieved all the goals that they had originally set. Wish You Were Here was a touching and intricate concept album that belies these problems and that paid a number of subtle tributes to the former frontman Syd Barrett.
So Wish You Were Here is quite a dark album.
Yeah, I think it's very cold and stark by comparison with Dark Side of the Moon, which is a very warm album. But I think that's a result of the fact that they had worldwide fame and fortune thrust upon them in an instant. But this is another number one album, but it's very much the opposite to Dark Side of the Moon. And there's a lot of tension within the band at that time, and I think that comes through on that album, definitely.
How much is it a group effort?
Very fraught period. I would say that there were a lot of internal squabbling at that time. Roger Waters, certainly, who had written Dark Side of the Moon, single-handedly, almost completely dreamt up the concept of Wish You Were Here, and it's an album that is starting to show his, if you like, unilateral control of the group.
The lush strains of the album's centrepiece, Shine On You Crazy Diamond, remains perennially popular, or the melancholy title track that became a live favourite for years to come. The album again topped the US charts, as well as giving the band their first number one since Atom Heart Mother, as remarkably, Dark Side of the Moon never went to number one in Britain. Despite the ever-gathering success that Pink Floyd was starting to enjoy, they've always exhibited a certain amount of reticence when it comes to doing interviews, as Rick Wright and Dave Gilmour explain.
If you ask an opinion about, let us say, religion, in inverted commas, if anyone is going to give you a sort of rundown on what they feel about anything, it's a sort of two-hour business, and then when they put 2 hours of interview down, they could probably go through it and cut it down to about half an hour. But you formulate your opinions more or less, you go along quite often. I do. Very easily swayed. And so anything we say would regret. But, I mean, generally, this is, from doing interviews before, one nearly always seems to regret everything one ever says, because things change, you know, and it's printed as sort of, if people made it very clear, interview on the 19th of March, opinions may have changed by the time you read this, it'd be one scene. But so often you're held to whatever you've, you know, said at one point for years.
So therefore you think that people who are asked a certain question, I mean, may not necessarily believe it, it's only answered on impulse.
Yes, I think that's often very true, particularly for interviews where the line, you know, the amount that's going to be written is maybe half a page, and the amount of time devoted to that question is not exactly yes-no answer, but it's two sentences.
Does it follow, therefore, that you believe that no one has any real concrete views about anything?
Oh, no. A lot of people have very concrete views about everything.
And they're seen as being coherent about them, you know, like student demonstrators and student leaders who people like Terry Carney. Yeah,
beautiful spokesman, superb. You could interview him, and he's lucid. He comes out with exactly what he means and what he believes. What I'm saying is
that on a stage, you know, with a bass guitar.
What I'm saying is, I'm a very confused youth of no special, you know, intelligence or anything else. But I happen to belong to a band which plays music which I find very exciting, which the audience appear to find exciting, and therefore, you know, why there's very little point in me sitting down and telling you my confused views on anything.
The band were now gigging fairly relentlessly around this time, selling out everywhere they played. They were now making mega money and had entered the super-rich tax bracket. As Roger Waters' socialist vision drifted further and further away from the modern-day Pink Floyd, who by now were almost overwhelmed by their commercial success, Waters' material was becoming even more vitriolic, offering a seething perspective on modern society. Such indictments, however, did not seem out of place in 1977, the year that punk broke, which is also when the band released their next album, Animals, on January the 23rd.
Released at the height of punk.
Height of punk, which actually is probably more scathing than any punk record that you're probably likely to buy at the time.
It's like two fingers up in a much more intellectual manner.
Yeah, definitely.
Rather than just swear words, it's a bit more...
Yeah, it's a thinking man's punk album. It's very interesting as a result, and there's some excellent musicianship on that, and I think the band play very well on that. And I think it's a very underrated album.
The album was an Orwellian concept piece, likening human beings to animals, even going as far as containing farmyard sounds to lend the right atmosphere. On Dogs, we get to hear one of Dave Gilmour's finest hours, with one of his best guitaring performances that stand up nicely to Waters' scathing lyrics about corporate greed. Ironically, it was probably Storm Thorgerson's famous cover that would remain in rock's collective consciousness the longest. Making Battersea Power Station one of London's most unlikely tourist attractions, it would feature a pig flying through the famous white chimneys, which was supposed to signify hope amid the dark themes explored throughout Animals. If Dark Side of the Moon would still be breaking sales records 25 years after its release, the most enduringly memorable album would have to be the sprawling double set The Wall, released on November the 30th, 1979, which quickly became one of the largest selling double albums of all time and contained 28 tracks. The film, directed by Alan Parker and starring Bob Geldof, easy musician, Pink, slowly going off the rails, extorted by the industry and paranoid by the power he appears to have over his own fans. Apart from a number of incidents drawn from rock and roll legend, there are many bibliographical similarities throughout with the decline of Syd Barrett and Roger Waters' ever-increasing feelings of isolation from Floyd's own audience, especially after Dark Side had put the band into the global mainstream. The film, primarily shot in a series of flashbacks, offers a stark and unappealing outlook on the world of rock, and is perhaps Waters' most self-indulgent and insurgent work up until that point, especially as it also contained even more references to his father's death in When the Tigers Broke Free and In the Flesh. However, although the themes explored were dark and sombre, the album contained some tremendous tracks, with a huge-selling single, Another Brick in the Wall, and the standout, Comfortably Numb, with Dave Gilmour's blistering guitar solo. Let's hear once again from renowned DJ and promoter J.J. Fowler.
And then, of course, they did the Wall, which... You know, for me, you know, Another Brick in the Wall was number one in England in 1979, and the album came out, and I bought that album because I loved the single. And again, what they were doing was just things that nobody else was trying then. I don't even know if people have tried since, but the film came out, and the film, you know, it starred, you know, Sir Bob Geldof, was absolutely fantastic, and, you know, was well directed, well made, and is a classic piece of movie making, and I think is one of the best rock films that's ever been made, you know, alongside Tommy, you know, which was The Who's film. It's a great film, you know, I own it on video, and I do watch it from time to time, and it's brilliant, but the album is stunning, you know. That's basically, you know, is the period, I think, that for me, you know, growing up around about that time, 19, you know, for me, 77, you know, where you had Star Wars came through in the cinema, then, you know, through to 79, where, you know, Alien, of course, came into the cinema, and that was where I kind of discovered Pink Floyd. You know, it was a period in my life that I remember vividly, and I remember that Pink Floyd had a very, very big part of.
Although the album was hugely successful, the band's problems began to escalate. Tensions that had been simmering for some time were clearly exasperated when the band's accountants, Norton Warburg, collapsed after Floyd had invested vast sums with them. They recorded The Wall nearly broke, and with Roger Waters' domination continuing to escalate, Rick Wright became the focus of the vocalist's ire. His input had been fairly minimal in the first place, but when Waters gave Gilmour and Mason an ultimatum to sack Wright or cancel the whole Wall project, the acute financial pressures meant that one of Pink Floyd's founding members had to go. After completing yet more touring on the strength of the huge success enjoyed by The Wall, including the epic concerts in New York, LA, London and Dortmund in Germany, where the band played while a cardboard wall was erected during the show, they, or rather their record company, released a collection of great dance songs on November the 23rd, 1981. Ostensibly, it was a collection of their greatest hits, with reworked versions of Shine On You Crazy Diamond, Wish You Were Here, and Another Brick in the Wall. In fact, Dave Gilmour entirely re-recorded Money, playing every instrument on the track except the saxophone. As an entity, however, Pink Floyd were beginning to deteriorate. The acrimonious disputes that Roger Waters had had with the director of The Wall, Alan Parker, over the interpretation of the film's screenplay, left him in no mood to compromise with the remaining band members over the making of the final cut, which was released on March 21st, 1983. Again a concept album, Waters vents his anger and frustration at Margaret Thatcher's Britain of the early 80s, the pointless loss of life in the Falklands War, and the shattering of the post-Second World War socialist dream. Although recorded in 8 different British studios, Waters' domination of things had now become so omnipotent that Dave Gilmour and Nick Mason had been reduced almost to the status of session musicians, and had very little say, if any, in the album's direction. This is a great pity because the album showcases some of Waters' most powerful and moving lyrics, and one can only wonder how great the album would have been if the studio atmosphere had been more harmonious and the band united. The Gunner's Dream stands out particularly as a musically haunting reference to the human waste of war, while the Fletcher Memorial Home is yet another tribute to Roger Waters' father, Eric Fletcher Waters, to whom the album is dedicated. The wonderfully mellow guitar solo provided by Dave Gilmour on the title track, The Final Cut, would indeed be just that for Pink Floyd.
Final cut's like the suicide note.
Yeah, it is. Absolutely. And it's not a band album, and I think that it shouldn't... I mean, my opinion is that it shouldn't have been a Pink Floyd album. It should have been a Roger Waters solo album. And I think that's very clear in it, because that's even more bleak than The Wall.
The final cut was the final cut, really.
Yeah, I mean, it spelt the end of Rick Wright's involvement with the band.
I mean, the band obviously believed that Pink Floyd continues, really, but I think in the eyes of the fans, the majority of them, Pink Floyd exist in name, but not in body.
Yeah, I think that's probably true to a certain extent. And I think the problem with the final cut, and that doesn't hold up very well as a Pink Floyd album, simply because a lot of their other concept albums have been deliberately vague or very open to interpretation. This one got too involved in politics at the time, and especially the Conservative government's involvement in the conflict in the Falklands.
The signs were on the wall when throughout 1984 and 85, all the band members released relatively unsuccessful solo albums. Roger Waters brought out the pros and cons of hitchhiking, demos of which had originally been rejected by Pink Floyd around the time of The Wall as being too personal. The album followed the narrator through a dream sequence, and most notably contained a number of memorable contributions from Eric Clapton, who also toured with Waters playing guitar on such Floyd classics as Eclipse, Money and Hey You. Dave Gilmour released the critically admired About Face, which also included a couple of lyrical contributions from Pete Townsend. Nick Mason, meanwhile, teamed up with former 10cc guitarist Rick Fenn and Mike Oldfield's band to release Profiles, a largely instrumental album, while Rick Wright brought out Identity, which saw him collaborate with former fashion lead singer Dave Harris. Then, in 1986, Roger Waters confirmed the inevitable that he was quitting, reasoning that Pink Floyd had become a spent force, and that as a band, they had reached the end of their shelf life. It must have come as something as a shock to Roger Waters then, that in time, Dave Gilmour and Nick Mason elected to continue working as Pink Floyd, and after drafting Rick Wright back into the fold, began working on a new album. Clearly infuriated, Waters began the first in a series of trenchant legal battles, centering on who actually owned the rights to the name of Pink Floyd, and that the planned new album was in fact comprised of just Gilmour and an army of nebulous session musicians. Waters may have had a point with the latter argument, and by Gilmour's own admission in years later, Wright and Mason's contribution to A Momentary Lapse of Reason had been sporadic, to say the least. Even though Roger Waters' next solo effort, Radio Chaos, preceded the new A Momentary Lapse of Reason by 3 months, and was the more definitively sounding Floyd album, Gilmore, Wright and Mason's album stormed to number 3 in both the States and the UK, proving conclusively that Pink Floyd's name still held a great deal of sway with the record-buying public. To promote the album, the three remaining members took off on a world tour that would eventually consist of a remarkable 199 shows, seen by a staggering 5.5 million fans, as it snaked its way quite literally around the globe. The tour would eventually gross in excess of $30 million, despite costing over $100,000 a day to run, and being so large that their gigs had to be staged outdoors and at the mercy of the elements. With such intensive gigging, it seemed only appropriate that a live album materialise at some stage. And Delicate Sound of Thunder duly appeared in November of 1988 as a double CD, covering songs taken in the most part from the Nassau Coliseum in New York. The bulk of Side 1 consisted of live versions of A Momentary Lapse of Reason, while the second comprised of a run-through of their greatest hits. Their incredible world tour culminated in June of 1990, when our intrepid threesome headlined a prestigious charity concert at Nebworth in England, in front of an astonishing 125,000 fans, making it the biggest concert ever since Band Aid. Not to be upstaged, though, a month later, Roger Waters performed The Wall in its entirety in Berlin to aid the Memorial Fund for Disaster Relief. It is easy to see how Waters would be attracted to such a project. Although his wall had been a mental one, the Berlin Wall that had starkly separated East from West was very much an abhorrent physical one. In July of 1990, 200,000 people squeezed into the Potsdamer Platz and roared their approval as Waters put on a spectacular show that included Van Morrison, Bryan Adams, Joni Mitchell, a 100-piece orchestra, a Russian marching band, and of course a wall that spread across the stage and comprised of 2,500 bricks and was a staggering 80 feet high. The show culminated with Waters' wall crashing down amid wild scenes from the assembled crowd. Quite simply, whatever you can do, I can do better. In 1992, Roger Waters released his third solo album, Amused to Death, but again it was modestly received. Even by his own admission, if it had carried the Pink Floyd moniker, it would have been a resounding success. Although the album featured Jeff Beck on guitar and a group of songs that sounded very much like the Pink Floyd of old in their composition, the 20th anniversary of Dark Side of the Moon was hovering ominously around the corner, and to Waters' dismay, he found himself competing with the past all over again. If Pink Floyd's previous world tour had thrown up some incredible numbers, the 1994 tour that started on the same day as the new album, The Division Bell, was released, would rewrite the record books all over again. The 200-strong crew that accompanied the band would eventually assemble their remarkable stage show in 77 cities during 110 concerts that would again be seen by over 5.5 million fans, grossing an astonishing $250 million. The album, released on March 30, 1994, topped both the UK and the US charts, selling over 6 million copies, and was enthusiastically received by both critics and fans alike. The album produced two singles. First came Take It Back, followed by High Hopes, which was co-written with Dave Gilmour by his wife, Polly Sampson, a former journalist. In fact, this unusual songwriting duo accounted for 6 of the album's tracks. As with their lengthy tour of the late 80s, once again they could not resist releasing a double live CD entitled Pulse, which came out at the latter end of 1995. Pulse contained another trip down memory lane, with live renditions of everything from 1967's Astronomie de Mine right up to tracks taken from The Division Bell. Let's have the final thoughts of Glenn Povey and Richard Allen.
Particularly in the 80s, underground music was very retrospective because the mainstream music at the time was so bland and uninteresting that people were starting to listen to a lot of older music. And that's the birth, really, of the whole retro reissue thing that's just taken off in a ridiculous level. In the 90s, that was the start of it, but obviously a lot of people started to listen to things they wouldn't have ordinarily listened to had the mainstream not been so boring. And Pink Floyd, definitely a major influence on underground music even now. Quite often bands have been quoted as being influenced by Pink Floyd. The Orb was the one that was probably the most widely touted, spiritualized. A lot of bands using a particular guitar sound. Porcupine Tree, which is the band that the biggest band on the Delirium Records, the label that we run, have often been compared to Pink Floyd. I think Pink Floyd started a wave of experimentation with popular music that has continued ever since. Radiohead particularly are following that direction. I mean, obviously, you use certain guitars and synthesizers, you're going to sound like Pink Floyd if they used them as well. But I think Pink Floyd music was very diverse. It was almost uniquely slow. I don't think I've ever heard a fast Pink Floyd track.
I read an interesting interview with Dave Gilmour saying that he actually cannot physically move his fingers very fast on a guitar fretboard, so that consequently you have a very slow melodic kind of tune to it.
Where do they go from here?
Well, there's this unwritten rule with Pink Floyd, isn't there, that, I mean, each of their tours becomes progressively more spectacular.
Do you think they will reform completely?
Wishful thinking, really, isn't it? But then, you never know. It's difficult to say. I kind of think too much has been said between the band members that would, I think that would prevent them from reforming. I don't think it would be an entirely happy relationship.
Pink Floyd's place in the annals of rock history is undoubtedly secure. A band whose unique music has now spanned four decades. They furnished the psychedelic scene with an apt group of spokesmen in the 1960s, and in the 1970s provided the decade's soundtrack with a phenomenal Dark Side of the Moon. The live extravaganzas of the 1980s set a performing benchmark that will never be topped, while in the 1990s they have introduced quite literally millions of new fans, most of whom were probably not even born when The Piper at the Gates of Dawn was released, to their inimitable sound. Pink Floyd have survived beyond Syd Barrett and have proven that they can survive without Roger Waters. But with the millennium fast approaching, it can only be hoped that the rift that exists between them can be healed and that Pink Floyd see us through into the next century, united once again and in interstellar overdrive.